Welcome to Tales from the Dance Floor, a podcast exploring the lives and times of people from all walks of life who followed their passions and made careers out of DJing, producing, parties, dance culture, and the music industry. I'm Phil Morse from Digital DJ Tips. Let's get started. So I'd like to welcome DJ Dan. And what I love about this podcast is that we get people on here who are already massively famous and successful, and people will not only maybe not have heard of them, but they won't even know that what they do exists. And you're one of those people, Dano. And as we tell your story, that's going to become obvious. So welcome to the podcast.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me, Phil. I really appreciate it.
Cool. Well, listen, Dan, you are from the Accent in the UK and your business is in the UK, but I'd like you to tell our audience what you do, what the monolithic thing that you run is. And I'm sure a lot of people will be like, wow. So off you go, Dan.
So I basically started a club night called Propaganda when I was 20. I started it with £400 of my student loan when I was a second year university student. Never expected it to become my full-time job. And God, now 17 years later, I'm still running Propaganda. It's the UK's biggest weekly club night. It's the UK's biggest indie night because essentially it is an indie night. So it's all kind of guitar-based music. So indie alternative rock sort of music that we play. We've done events in Australia. We've held some events in America and Brazil with co-promoters as well. And we're in around about 15 cities across the UK.
That's incredible, Dan. And
thank you.
Quite unique, I would say. Clearly, there are student nights and there are student events all over the world.
Definitely. But we're really careful not to describe Propaganda as a student night, just because we want everyone to be able to come to Propaganda and enjoy it.
In that case, Dan, I stand corrected, and I would say there are nights that have grown out of the university.
I started off as a student night because I was a student.
And I guess the reason that I kind of fall into the trap, if you like, of describing what you do as a student event is that students tend to like the kind of music you play. So, of course, students nowadays like everything, right? There's no such thing as liking one kind of music in the Spotify age. But what you do, running an indie event, that has a certain flavour and has a certain set of presumptions attached to it, and you've already started to try and break those talking to me. So talk to me about it. I mean, you've been doing it for 17 years. What's changed in 17 years of running an indie event nationwide in the United Kingdom?
Oh my God, so much has changed. And I think you really touched upon one of the crucial factors is people aren't tribal with their music tastes anymore. You know, when I grew up and I suppose I was a teenager becoming quite aware of music, you very much identified with the genre of music that you're into. So, you know, if you're into indie music, pretty much that's all you'd necessarily listen to. And that probably dictated what you did socially, kind of going to gigs and festivals and probably maybe the way you dressed as well. Whereas now, I think in the Spotify generation, there's so much access to music that people don't associate with a genre in the same sort of way. So the same person who might listen to Oasis or The Strokes will also maybe listen to a house DJ or maybe some pop music, depending on whatever mood they're into. And I just don't think that people are necessarily as passionate about a music genre in the way they used to be, which, you know, has been challenging running largely an indie-based club night for the last 17 years, because when we first started it, people certainly believed that they were into indie music and passionate about indie music, and that's what they liked. Whereas nowadays, I think people aren't necessarily sure of the genre that they really associate with or don't associate with that genre in the same sort of way, and don't have that passion for that. So as a club night, which has largely sold itself on a genre, we've had to really open the way that we describe it. And now we use artists and bands a lot more to describe the music that we're playing, rather than just saying we're an indie alternative night. We might list a few different artists to describe what we're playing, so that people maybe realize that actually I am going to enjoy this night and it is for me, because I think sometimes people see the word indie and it can turn them off. So we've got to be quite conscious of that. So I think the way that people are far less tribal towards a genre and about types of music has really affected the way that we promote it. And really, propaganda was never meant to be an exclusively indie night. We've always played other genres. So, you know, we might play a couple of indie tracks, then we go on to some dance tracks, and then go back to indie, and then maybe play some heavier rock tracks, maybe play a few pop curveballs. And largely it is indie and guitar music that we go back to. But we're not exclusively an indie night. And I think we've had to open the gates of what we play even more, just because people's genres or the music they're into is just so much wider than it probably was sort of 5-10 years ago.
It's fascinating you should talk about that. And I can talk to you as a DJ, right? Because you've always DJed at your own events.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so, I'm still DJing maybe like 5-6 times a month, maybe even more than that, to be honest. So to be honest, I absolutely love the DJing and the promoting and all the kind of other side of it and kind of running the company that comes along with it. And probably I don't enjoy as much as being at our events and DJing. You know, I think when you're at an event and DJing, it reminds you of why you do this and why you love it so much. And you just vibe off the audience and the crowd. So I still DJ our events a lot.
So my question is based around this idea that there is no such thing as a ghetto of one kind of music or another nowadays. And I think one way of looking at it, which must be something you thought about, is if you're in a big city, what city do you live in, Dan?
I live in Bristol. I'm from London.
Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, actually, it doesn't really matter now because some of the things I'm about to talk about have become more national in the United Kingdom. But, you know, you have genre music stations, right, that tend to base what they do around a particular genre. And I think we've seen that change as well. And while you might have a dance station and a rock station and a pop station, there's always tracks that all of them are playing, right? Right. There's always tracks that completely cross over. So is that your experience? Have you just found tracks that refuse to be categorized and that work just as well with your audience, and that there might be the same track being played in the local house club or whatever?
Absolutely. You know, I think people aren't genre specific in the way that they used to be. I think people's music tastes are just so much wider. And I think there's probably a real crossover in certain tracks you could probably hear in a variety of different clubs in the same city.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, definitely. Look, let's talk about the meteoric rise, if you like, of what you've done. So what year was it that you had your 200 capacity club at the age of 20?
I'm trying to work it out. If it was 2001 and 2002, you know, I think it's unbelievable that we're still here, like 17 years later, still promoting the same club night and still having survived all these changes. But yeah.
You're playing to 25,000 people a week across the globe, mainly in the UK, but also Australia and America, Brazil and Ibiza. And you've thrown parties all over the place. And just a quick look at your website, you know, you have several events on every night. You're like the Cirque du Soleil of club nights.
I will say that. I just had to Google it. It's 2002 that propaganda first started.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, it's a meteoric rise. And I am interested in this this change. You know, you just said it yourself. You just Googled it. Back in 2002, the internet was there, but and as a club promoter myself back at that time, you know, we were using it. We had forums and websites, but really it was still footwork and posters and flyers and absolutely word of mouth. And,
yeah.
You know, you
physical promotion. And, you know, yeah, when I first started propaganda, I used to do everything myself. I used to go and do the flyering, put the posters up, DJ the event from start to finish. The only thing I didn't do was take the money on the door, which someone from my student halls, a good friend of Michael Pedro, used to do. And other than that, I used to do everything, all the basics. And I think it was crucial.
So my question is, how has, back to this idea of what's changed in this mammoth length of time, how have you dealt with the challenge and the opportunities given to you by social media, by Facebook, by online? What's been some things that you feel you've done well? What have you struggled with? Give me a picture of how your business has changed with social media arriving.
So I suppose one of the biggest challenges right now is the cost of social media promotion compared to what people are paying on the front door, because really we haven't put our entry prices up that much over the last 17 years, but the cost of promoting has risen hugely, I feel, because you have to spend so much on social media to get a bit of impact. When it first came about, kind of the growth of Facebook and social media, I think a lot of promoters did very well on just using Facebook cleverly, and they had, you know, fake profiles and different techniques that didn't necessarily cost a lot of money, but managed to generate a lot of hype for an event and really successfully promote their events online. I think these days it's very hard to reach people on social media without spending a lot of money to do so. Mm. So for us, we spend a lot on a weekly basis across all of our events promoting largely on Facebook and Instagram. We are still firm believers in physical promotion. So we will still do shop runs, taking flyers and posters around to shops in a city that will take them, and kind of getting posters up in key areas. We certainly don't spend as much as on that as we did previously, but we still feel it's important to be doing that aspect of promotion. We're certainly not some of these promoters that only promote online. We feel it's important to have a balance of physical promotion and social media spend. Someone once said to me, you know, if you throw enough mud at a stick, eventually enough of it will stick. And it's kind of a bit of a case of that, where you're throwing social media at people and you're also throwing flyers and posters. And eventually, I think if they've had a few touch points to your promotion, they'll notice it. But if you're only promoting on social media or you're only promoting physically, I don't think it's enough. I think you need to do a mixture of the two.
I think there's a lot in that. From my, again, referring back to my, thinking back to my own days as a promoter, excuse me, we used to say that you need to hear about us six times before you'll even think about coming.
Absolutely.
And they need to be in six different places. It can't be six times on Facebook. That doesn't count. It has to be a friend, has to be a mixtape, has to be seeing something on the bus on the way to town, on the wall. It has to be a flyer from somewhere, seeing you read about in a magazine, mentioned in a magazine, and the online stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a tipping point and people will trust that you're real, I think. I think that's the thing, isn't it? Trusting that you're real and that they're not going to have a terrible night if they come, because you're big enough to guarantee it's good. It can't be that bad, right?
Definitely.
So, all right then. You have got these nights running all over the place, yeah, every weekend. What have you learned as someone who used to do it all yourself on foot, to being basically the CEO of an organization where you have to trust other people? What have you had to learn that you didn't know that you'd have to learn at the beginning of this?
I think for me, one of the hardest switches was when it became from being a hobby to actually, this is my business. And, you know, I had a real point of doubt. Is this what I want to be doing? Because I always started propaganda because I had a love for indie music and guitar music. I had a love for DJing as well, which I didn't necessarily know when I started it, but you know, it was a real passion for music that led me to start propaganda. And it very much started as a hobby. You know, I was at university at the time. I studied at Bristol Uni. It's how I ended up in Bristol, where I still live. And I launched a night on £300 of my student loan, just expecting it to be something that I did on the side of university. And then, you know, there were points that I almost quit university, but I managed to graduate and still come away with a 2-1, and then was left in this situation where actually I suddenly realized this should become my job, because at the time I was, you know, doing quite well off the night, and actually it was becoming a viable income. And that mindset, just switching from it becoming a hobby to becoming a business, I found a little bit difficult, but something that needed to happen. And I think one of the key things in order to grow the night for me doing everything was accepting that I would have to step away from doing certain things. And in order to grow, I couldn't keep hold of everything. This couldn't just be my baby, which, you know, it starts off as your baby because it's the night that you created and I did everything, but you need to know, I think, when to step away and when to bring in other people who you can trust to do that promotion. So we have a real structure in place with propaganda. In each of our cities, we have someone who's called a city manager, and they're responsible for all the day-to-day promotion of propaganda in that city. We then have a few area managers. Each one has about four city managers who they oversee, so they provide the extra support. They'll work with their city manager to give them a budget to spend on the physical promotion. And I suppose the city manager essentially is the face of propaganda in that city. They're going around talking to people about the night. They're there on a weekly basis because pretty much all of our events are weekly, and they're the ones on the front door. They're organising all the staffing. And they're very much that face of propaganda in that city. And then myself and a guy called Jules, who's our operations director, we oversee the area managers, and I suppose also the city managers as well. But there's a real kind of structure in place. It's an expensive structure because, you know, we're quite staff heavy. And, you know, when we were talking before about the spend on social media, you know, you've had to, we've got a large cost base to still fund on a weekly basis, which in the current climate can be quite challenging. But yeah, I suppose we've got that structure, and that's really what sets us aside from other club nights. And
yeah, so how, back to the DJing, how easy do you find it is to turn off from all that in those kind of hallowed moments where you're behind the decks, you've got your music, and it's just you and the crowd? Can you turn off? Are you still half looking at the door out your corner of your eye and watching your phone and thinking about the other events? You know, how easy is it to switch from CEO and promoter to DJ?
Yeah, I suppose it's a challenge, but when you're DJing in front of people, you've got to be able to switch off and just engage with those people. And, you know, there's quite a lot of times that I have to consciously not go to my phone while DJing, because you've got to engage with people and you've got to put on a good show. And as a DJ, I think it's so important that you're giving them the all, regardless of whether you're concerned, oh, is it a quiet night, or, you know, concerned how another city might be doing. I think you need to really be in the moment, which is easier said than done.
Yes, I can imagine. And I'm interested in your kind of career as a DJ, apart from the organisation that you've built, because you said at the beginning that you didn't know that you liked DJing when you started your club night. It kind of crept up on you and you realised that actually this was something you enjoyed. And being an indie DJ is different to being a dance DJ or a mixing DJ. You know, at what point did you actually think, hang on a second, I actually am a DJ here? And at what point, you know, were you just thinking, oh, I'm just playing records, I'm not really a DJ? At what point did you think, actually, no, I am, I'm a real DJ?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, actually. The amount of DJs you speak to that seem to have fallen into it, that didn't necessarily set off to become a DJ, I find remarkable. But for me, I had a passion for music. And I used to play drums in a band, and I always used to want to be a drummer in a band. And when I came to university, there was just a guy flying on the street, and I thought, you know what, I'll take a chance. I'll ask him if he needs a DJ, because I'd never DJed at that point. And I'd gone to indie nights growing up in London, and I suppose that kind of, I suppose I had a passion of going to indie club nights. And I went up to a guy who was flying for a night and said, look, I played drums in a band. I'd also edited a music website during my year out between going to university. And I said, I've never DJed before. I'd love to DJ. Do you need any DJs? And it was really interesting. He was working for a promoter who was based about an hour from Bristol, who had just launched a night in Bristol. And essentially, I suppose, was looking for someone to help them out in Bristol. And here I was, a first-year student. I'd been in the city for about a week. And I remember, so the guy who was flying said, come down, meet Andy, who runs the club night, I think later tonight. And actually, it was still my freshers' week. And I'd went out with my new friends from Halls, who had only just met a few days beforehand, and we went to a club night in Bristol, and it was terrible. It was absolutely awful. And I said to them, oh, well, this guy said if I go to this club night, I could potentially DJ. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, that sounds really cool. So we all left this awful club night, went to this other night, and I spoke to Andy, who ran the night. And he said to me, yeah, yeah, bring some CDs next week, because it was CDs in those days. Bring some CDs and you can DJ. And now I'd never DJed before. And the following week, I turned up and I brought a whole pile of my personal CDs. And Andy, in the middle of the night, just let me DJ, essentially. And I played the first two tracks and he kind of oversaw it and showed me how to do it. And in those days, I think it was the double dual Denon CD players, really showing my age here.
We know them well.
DJs. And Andy let me DJ. And on the third track, I played the Smiths, Stop Me If You Think You've Heard This One Before, which for me was my favourite Smiths song. It was, I think a few years later, Mark Ronson actually covered it and it did become a big song. But at the time, I suppose it was just essentially an album track. It isn't like one of the Smiths' most well-known songs. And I played it and it literally cleared the dance floor. And Andy turned around to me and he said, I wanted you to do that so you could see what not to do. And to be honest, that was one of the most important lessons to me and still really sits with me today and really resonates with me, because essentially it taught me that I needed to play for the dance floor. I needed to play to the dance floor. And my job as a DJ was to keep people dancing. And at that point, I'd absolutely failed. And he took me off the decks. But I learned so much from that point. And I think regardless of the type of music you're playing, you've got to play to the dance floor. And, you know, you could be the greatest technical DJ, but unless you're playing songs that people want you to or want to dance to, I just don't think anyone's really going to care. Or maybe some DJs who are into the technical side will care, but ultimately the average person going to a club night wants to dance, and your job and role as a DJ is to get them dancing. And, you know, the first time I DJed, I learned that thanks to Andy King, who said to me, well, allow me to play that song. Because I think if I'm teaching a DJ to DJ now and showing them how to kind of play in Propaganda, I would have stepped in and said, or I do step in and say, oh, you know, that track probably isn't right for this point in the night. Maybe it's a great warm-up track, but I wouldn't play that now. But he let me play it. He let me clear the dance floor in his club night, and I learned so much from it.
So it's interesting you say that, because I was talking to a guy called Lohan Presenter, who's the Ministry of Sound chairman, last week on this very podcast. And I said, look, you've been in charge there for two decades. The club's nearly 30 years old. What advice would you give to DJs? And he said, you've got to play for the floor. And this is a guy who's booked every, you know, superstar DJ in the world, including some of the most technically proficient DJs. And that's what he says, exactly his words. So it's interesting that you talk about that, because as someone who's clearly passionate about music, which, by the way, is the only thing we teach, we can't give you digital DJ tips. We say, look, we can get you where you want to go, but the only thing that you need is a passion for music. I'm kind of putting myself in the shoes of the guy who you approached to talk about this, the flyer chap in the street.
Yeah.
And, you know, you saying, I'm in a band, or I've been in a band, I play drums, I love music. You know, they're the things that you want to hear when you're considering whether someone has got it in them to be a DJ or not. So as someone who DJs indie, who DJs music that doesn't need mixing, these tracks are finished, right? You don't need to do much to them to play them. How important is programming that music from your point of view? You know, the records could be all good, but how important is getting that order right?
Yeah. No.
And what is the skill? What does a DJ have to do? What is a DJ doing in public, stood there with a crowd in front of him or her, that he or she cannot do in a bedroom in order to get that right or otherwise?
Yeah, I think getting the flow right is absolutely crucial, because, you know, with playing indie alternative music and guitar music, there's a lot of different like speeds and a lot of different styles of music. And certainly, you know, we throw in curveballs. So, you know, we play like Darude Sandstorm or Zombie Nation, and just songs that you would not expect to hear in an indie alternative night. And I think you've got to structure your set right so that it works well. And I think I've just managed to go with a vibe. And I'm the first to admit that I'm not the best technical DJ, but I think I've got a skill of playing the right songs at the right time. And I suppose when you're structuring your set, because quite often with Propaganda, we'll have one DJ that will play the whole night. So, you know, it can be sometimes a 6 hour set. You might DJ from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. And so you're not coming in and doing like an hour set or a 2 hour set, which you might do as a guest DJ. You're having to play the full 6 hours. And it's knowing when to play certain songs and not blowing all the big hits too early is absolutely crucial, because the last thing you want to do is kind of play all the huge dance floor songs too soon in the night and then lose the dance floor for the last hour or two. So I think it's crucial that you build your set correctly. I always say to DJs when I'm teaching them to DJ at Propaganda, because it is a skill, I think, to DJ our night, slightly different from other indie alternative nights and other club nights. You know, I think the hardest point to play is almost that crossover period between sort of a 11:15 and maybe a 11:45, when, you know, the dance floor is starting to warm up, but it's not fully going. So you don't want to go and play a massive song, but you also need to get people going. And it's the point, I think, almost you've got to be really into your music and play good stuff that's going to get people dancing, but not blow all the big tunes, essentially. So that's the point. I think you've really got to know what you're doing.
Interesting. The warm-up, it was always my favourite.
Yeah.
Always my favourite part of DJing, the warm-up. Like you say, it's hard to get right. And DJs that do it well tend to get noticed. It's another thing that we found.
Especially when you're warming up for someone else as well, because you don't want to play all the big songs
when
they're about to go on.
Yeah, I mean, I remember once thinking, oh, we had a big DJ on, I can't remember who now, but I thought, oh, it'd be really respectful to play one of their tracks just to show them that we like them. And, you know, that it turns out is a very bad thing to do. And I learned very early myself. So talking of superstars and DJs and so on, you have booked and had playing for you plenty of names that people will know from the worlds of rock and roll and so on. And I'm looking at a list now on your website. You've got the Libertines, the Vaccines, Two Door Cinema Club, Bombay Bicycle Club, Vampire Weekend, Franz Ferdinand, Kaiser Chiefs, loads more.
Yeah, we've had like Mumford & Sons, even randomly James Corden has DJed for us at Propaganda, which was like a totally impromptu DJ set. Calvin Harris randomly did a set of Propaganda in Dublin, which you never would have expected. So we've had a real variety of artists come and DJ for us.
How many of them can actually DJ? And how do you sometimes think, oh God, I wish I hadn't put them on?
Yeah, many times. It can be quite heartbreaking when you've got a packed dance floor and everyone is really keen to see the guest DJ, and they come on and they play an absolutely awful set.
Because, yeah,
again, getting back to that point of people wanting to dance to stuff they know, sometimes, you know, bands and artists, when they come and DJ, they won't necessarily approach it as a DJ should do, and they'll come and they'll play their favourite tunes. And we all know that's not what you can do, or that's not what to do as a DJ. You know, you've got to be careful not to just come and play your favourite songs, which might not necessarily be other people's favourite songs, and probably is a whole load of tracks that people don't know. So yeah, it's been quite difficult when we've had a guest DJ and you've paid them a lot of money and they clear the dance floor. And what we've tried to do is to combat that is just give them a bit more kind of musical direction. So we've got a list of the top 200 tracks played at Propaganda, which one of our DJs, Sam's, actually put together. And we all, or the majority of us, DJ using Serato Propaganda, and we use videos in Propaganda because it gives that extra dimension to the nights. And the nice thing about that is you can pull off your playlist from Serato. So Sam, I don't know how he does it, using some wizardry, has managed to compile our top 200 tracks played from all the DJs, kind of giving them their set list and uploading them. We've got a staff DJ system where you can upload your set list and give feedback on the night. So he's taken all those set lists and compile them in top 200. And then we've tried to give that to guests when they DJ at Propaganda, so they don't just come and clear the dance floor. But even with all that direction, it still happens. And you still get DJs that come and, yeah, don't play correct for our crowd and lose the floor, which is, yeah, heartbreaking.
It must be, because I get the sense that you're a fan. At the end of the day, you're a fan, right? You, these people are your heroes. And that's why you're into their music. That's why it's kind of a dream come true to book them to play at your events, really? Right?
And maybe I'm not a fan of everyone that comes to our night, but there's certainly a lot of fans of those bands there. And,
yeah,
you know, it can be quite funny or difficult when you see people super excited to see that artist at the start, and by the end of their set, they look a bit bored. But having said all that, we've had some guest DJs who have been amazing and have played some great sets. I'm only kind of talking about the worst case scenarios.
Yeah, like, yeah.
We've had plenty that have come and absolutely rocked it. And we try and maybe book a DJ for one city, see how it goes. And if it works well, then they might come and do like a Propaganda tour, do 10 dates across the different Propaganda nights.
Yeah, that makes sense. So talk to me about your personal DJing. I know that you've DJed on an Oasis tour, am I right?
Yes, I became Oasis's after show DJ.
Wow, so tell us about that.
An absolute dream come true for me. Oasis have been my favourite band since I was 13 and probably really played a part in shaping my love for indie music and essentially my musical awakening. You know, when you're just really getting into music in your early teenage years and finding your passion for it, Oasis were the first proper band I got into, and then off the back of that, I think it encouraged me to play drums, and really they were such an influence on my life. And it originally started, a DJ I knew had played a couple of after show DJ sets for them and couldn't do a gig. I think it was in Milton Keynes Bowl years and years ago, and just asked me to cover it. And the band and their management loved my set so much that after every time they needed an after show DJ, they came to me, which was fantastic. And actually on their last stadium tour, I toured with them and did all the after show parties on their last stadium tour. And I've continued to do a few little bits for Noel. So I played for Noel Gallagher's End of World Tour party a few years ago, which was pretty incredible because it was quite a small party and he was on the dance floor himself asking me for loads of requests. And it's, yeah, pretty intimidating when your hero's on the dance floor, but you know, it keeps you on your toes, and it's, yeah, fantastic. It was a real dream come true for me.
That sounds amazing. So you must have some stories. Is there anything you're prepared to share with us about what goes on after hours on Oasis, yeah, on our Oasis tour?
There must be so many stories. I remember doing a Brit Awards after party for them when they'd won their Outstanding Achievement Award at the Brit Awards, and literally everyone who'd been at the Brit Awards came to this party afterwards in London in this tiny club. And even like people who hadn't been to the Brit Awards came, because I remember the Arctic Monkeys didn't bother turning up to the Brit Awards but actually still came to this Oasis after party and were dancing on the dance floor. And, you know, I was really nervous what to play. Literally so many bands and celebrities were in this club. And Liam Gallagher was the first person on the dance floor. So he was literally on his own, I think, dancing to The Coral while people were arriving at this party, which was amazing to see. And it was just such a funny scenario where so many of the bands I would normally play were actually in the room. So it's kind of working out what you play so that you're not favouring and playing any of the bands at the party. So it's working out what music to play. And yeah, I ended up just kind of going down a real kind of 60s route and kind of some of the older stuff. And I remember doing a few parties where Noel was at, and he absolutely loves the Beatles and loves Kasabian. And I remember, I think at that End of World Tour party for him, he'd just come up to me after every song and just ask me for a different Beatles song and a different Kasabian song. So I literally got into the position where I think I was playing a Beatles song and then a Kasabian song and then a Beatles song and then a Kasabian song. Because you know what? No one says no to Noel Gallagher. If he's asking for Beatles or Kasabian to be played at his party, you're going to play that. Even if you've just played a Beatles song two songs ago, you're still going to play it. Because, you know, I have a firm rule that I don't play the same artist within 45 minutes or maybe an hour of each other. But when Noel Gallagher's asking, there is no rules. You're playing his songs.
It's a bit like the bride at a wedding.
Absolutely.
There's generally one person in the room at any party that you can't say no to. And I think you've stumbled over that one. So do you have a superstar? If you were scrolling through your phone, do you have the kind of superstar on speed dial list that we would imagine from the stories you've been telling, or is it kind of still a bit more down to earth when you're away from that scene?
I have a few, yeah, famous people in my phone book. I tend not to bother them though.
Awesome. That's it's great to hear. You know, I was talking earlier about not playing a track by a DJ who's from a band who's coming on later, not to steal their thunder, but there's you with all the bands on the dance floor. Must have been a very strange feeling.
It's a scenario. And the funny thing about those parties, quite often, no one will dance unless, like, one of the famous people essentially will dance. So, you know, everyone's standing around looking quite cool, wants to be seen there. As soon as Noel Gallagher started dancing on the dance floor, everyone danced. But until that point, hardly anyone danced. It was quite intimidating as a DJ, especially that End of World Tour one I did, because I think no one really started dancing till like 1 or 2 in the morning. I was like, oh no, am I doing a bad job here? And then as soon as Noel danced, everyone started dancing and no one really left the dance floor until he went home. And I think I'd been booked to finish it, I can't remember, around like 3 o'clock, but the party didn't finish till 5 because he didn't leave till 5. So yeah, it was a great night.
Again, similarities with wedding DJs. Yeah. As soon as the bride and groom hit the dance floor, everyone else does.
And that's what first dance, I suppose.
So look, you mentioned Milton Keynes Bowl. That's somewhere that I've been. I saw Eminem there years ago. So huge, huge venues. What point do your family and parents think, stop thinking, when's Dan going to get a real job?
It's funny. My parents have always been really supportive of what I do. I don't think they necessarily really understood what I did initially. And I remember, I think the first propaganda we did in London was like a one-off at Coco. And I invited my parents down to that. And it was really funny because my dad's really into dancing and he literally danced the whole night away on the balcony at Coco while I was DJing. And I think up until that point, I don't think they really understood what it was that I did, because, you know, I suppose it's quite an alien concept to be a promoter and be a DJ. It's something very different to see your son do that. But they've always been really supportive of me. I think the only time they were concerned was when I was having second thoughts on, do I still continue my degree? Or, you know, propaganda's doing well, should I just be focusing on that? And they, at that point, kind of convinced me to stay at university, which I think was absolutely the right decision, because it's always good to have that degree that you can fall back on.
What did you study?
I did politics and sociology. So something totally different to how I've ended up kind of DJing and promoting and running live music venues. But it was 6 hours a week. So I only had 6 hours, I think 3 hours of lectures, 3 hours of seminars. And then the rest of the time I was meant to be reading, but actually I was largely promoting. So I had plenty of time to be promoting propaganda.
Well, be it from me to judge in any way, shape or form how hard degrees are, but I think sociology and politics is probably one of the easier ones if you have got an all-consuming business burgeoning on the sides, right?
Absolutely. Well, you know, 6 hours a week, it certainly allowed me to do that on the side.
Talking of, you say it's nice to have something to fall back on. You've been doing this for 17 years. How much longer will you be doing it for? Have you got plans for, I know you have, you've dabbled in having a record label and radio shows and Glastonbury, and, you know, there's other things that you're up to. Where's it going? Or does it have a shelf life?
You know what? I'm still asking myself that question. I absolutely love DJing. And I remember being 21 and thinking, I'm going to do this till I'm 30. And I got to 25 and like, nah, maybe I'm going to do this past I'm 30. And then when I got to my 30s, I'm like, yeah, I'll keep doing this till I'm 40. And, you know, I still have such a passion for DJing. I still absolutely love it. But I'm also conscious, you know, you've got to be on top of things and in touch with the crowd. And I try really hard to do that. And, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and I still love DJing, but I am aware there'll become a point where I'll need to stop and do other things. And about 3 years ago, I started working with some live promoters called MJR, and we built a venue together in Cardiff called Tramshed, which is a 1,000 capacity live music venue. And I very much saw that as my progress, I suppose, going on from promoting to co-owning and running live music venues. And we've got Tramshed in Cardiff. We've then gone on to buy a few other venues. So we've bought the Assembly in Leamington Spa, Plug in Sheffield, the Warehouse in Leeds, which is actually one of the oldest nightclubs in the country. It's celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. It's got a huge amount of heritage there. So kind of live music venues I saw as my, and nightclubs I saw as my progress. However, now I've been doing that for 3 years, I can assure you there's very little money in it. And it's very easy for venues and nightclubs to turn into huge money pits and pick up a lot of money and take up a lot of time. So I'm not sure exactly if that's my route I'm going to go into. But at the moment, that's where I'm at. I'm still promoting propaganda, still DJing, still loving that. I've got these live music venues as well, which are a challenge, but some of them are working well. We also have done a propaganda records, which you touched on before. Basically, we were very conscious that as propaganda has grown so much, we wanted to be seen and we wanted to really support new and up and coming artists. So our most recent release was by an artist called Youngblood, who at the time had just been signed by a major label, but no one had really heard of him. So we did a single release with him. We did a propaganda records vinyl, even though he'd been signed by this major label, and did a whole tour. He played about 15 propagandas around the country, and it was amazing. And he's gone on to some really big things. He's actually got a date in Brixton Academy later on this year, which he's headlining himself, and he's been hugely successful around the world. So it was great to play a part in his progress at the start, really. And we want to continue to support up and coming artists, and are always looking for artists to release and kind of have play at propaganda, but they just have to be the right ones. So, you know, I suppose we've got a lot of different strings to the propaganda bow. And so we've got the record label, we've got the venues, we've got the promoting, we've got the events. And I think in the current climate with nightclubs, that's what you need to do. I think you have to have a variety of different things as well, because it's quite a challenging climate.
So talking about varieties of things, do you notice any difference in musical taste across the country? Do people going out to your Scottish clubs listen to different music to those on the south coast of England, for instance?
It's interesting. I definitely feel there's a lot more of a divide than there was maybe like 5-10 years ago. I think in the north of the country, guitar music is definitely more popular. And I think the Cortinas is a great example of that. You know, the Cortinas will play arenas and even a large outdoor festival. I think they've done themselves in Manchester. And I think they've done a week of arenas in Manchester. But around the rest of the country, you don't see the same appetite for them, or especially down the south, that you do. And I don't think we really saw that kind of divide previously. But it does feel like certainly guitar music and certain sounding bands are more popular up north.
Interesting, considering that received wisdom says the internet has kind of leveled all that kind of stuff out, and a track can immediately be big all over the world. You know, in the blink of an eye, and yet this, your experience is that this is actually becoming more tribal, more geographically tribal.
It's only certain artists though as well. But another good example, I suppose, is Jerry Cinnamon, who got absolutely massive in Scotland, and I think off the back of the hype in Scotland, everyone else around the country has started to explore him, and his tour sold out nationally in minutes. So
yeah, so maybe it's just maybe, it just takes time to spread, yeah, kind of thing.
But it does feel like bands like Cortinas or even like Catfish and the Bottlemen, and the more kind of the traditional sounding guitar bands do seem to have more support up north. But that's just my experience kind of playing at Propaganda. And I suppose to contradict that, it's funny because our largest Propaganda city at the moment is Norwich. So, you know, that
which for those of our listeners are, you know, somewhere in southern USA or somewhere else, is eastern England, and it's actually quite a quite a remote part of
it
England,
is.
I think.
Yeah,
it's truth be told.
City.
Yeah. All right. So Dan, to end off this, there'll be people listening to this really, really inspired by you. You know, the idea that they can play the kind of music that maybe wouldn't be associated with club nights if you're being lazy about it, and that it works and that you've managed to build an empire doing just that, will give a lot of people a lot of, it'll take away a lot of their excuses, I think.
I need more DJs as well.
Propaganda is online, people. It's at thepropaganda.com. Go there, let Dan know if you're screaming to get on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think everyone gets into DJing, or a lot of people get into DJing and want to play dance music, and they don't necessarily realize that there is an opportunity to play other genres. And you know, guitar music, especially in the UK, still does really well in clubs and has a good following. Yet when people are getting into DJing, they don't necessarily think about playing, you know, indie and guitar music. So I always find there's a bit of a shortage of indie DJs. So if there's anyone there, by all means, get in contact. Look us up at thepropaganda.com. Email me, dan@thepropaganda.com, because I'm always looking to find more DJs.
And tell Dan where you came from when you do.
Yeah, please do. It's interesting as well, because the whole dancing to indie music in clubs, it does feel like it's a real UK and European thing, because we've done a few events in America. We've done an event in LA, an event in New York, and we had a night in Chicago that ran for quite a bit. And the amount of Americans that just didn't really seem to get the concept of dancing to indie and guitar music in a club environment, it was really interesting, because for me it felt like a natural progression that we'd done really well in the UK, and America, you know, such a huge country, so passionate about music, gigs and festivals do really well there, yet no one was really doing what we do in the UK in America. So, you know, we started to dip our foot into it, and I got visas to go out and play there, and we invested a lot in a few events. And just people didn't really seem to understand the whole concept of dancing to a guitar music in a nightclub, which I found so strange. But I think it's just like real cultural differences. And I hope one day in the future, you know, guitar music and rock music will do well in nightclubs out there. But we found it.
Well, it's not like they haven't got the bands.
Completely.
We have a large
opportunity to do some events there.
Yeah, we have a very large US audience. About 40% of our audience is US. Mm. So anyone out there listening to this stateside thinking, that's my opportunity, you know, seriously, go for
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You know, how we did events in Brazil, someone just got in contact with me and said, I was studying in England. I used to come to Propaganda all the time. I'm promoting events in Brazil. We'd love to bring Propaganda here. And it went hugely well when we've done events out there. And we're always looking for people to co-promote in other countries and other cities. So by all means, if you think Propaganda could work in your city and you're listening and think there's an opportunity there, get in contact.
So we've talked about DJs. We've talked about what it takes to DJ indie music. If someone's listening to you thinking, I'd like to get into promoting, I want to put a little indie night on in my town or city. What would you, looking back on your 17 years of doing this, what would your kind of number one piece of advice be to a budding promoter who wants to promote an event in order to book themselves to do the DJing? What would your, you know, if someone asked you that in the street now, what would you say to them? What should they do?
I think make sure you cover everything. So, you know, make sure you're doing the physical promotion, make sure you're doing online promotion, and just try and develop that word of mouth buzz, because it's such a hard thing to do, isn't it, to create a word of mouth buzz, but it's the best form of promotion. And I suppose with DJing, if you're going to go and DJ your event, make sure you're playing the music that people want to dance to, because that's the most crucial thing.
Awesome. Dan, thank you very much for spending the time.
No, thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it. It's great to have an opportunity to talk about the history of propaganda and kind of how I got into DJing.
It's fantastic. And it's what this podcast is all about. Uncovering things that people didn't even know they didn't know. You know, things that just, wow. It's a whole scene. It's a whole music genre. And you've made a huge success of it.
Thank you.
And shared some amazing stories. So, Dan, thank you very much for your time today. You can find out about the Propaganda Club. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. Multinational.
Yeah.
At thepropaganda.com online, and they've also, you can get links.
Yeah, and if you're going to Glastonbury, I'm playing an 11-hour DJ set on the Thursday night in the Silent Disco in the dance stage. It tends to be my tradition. I think this will be like the fourth or fifth time that I do it, an 11-hour DJ set. It's challenging to DJ for that amount of time, but it's also great fun. So if you're going to Glastonbury Festival, please come and check me out on the Thursday night, kicking off the festival with Propaganda at the Silent Disco and the Silver Haze stage. And yeah, by all means, find us online. Thepropaganda.com is our website. You can find me on Instagram, DJ Dan, or on Facebook as well. Yeah, it'd be great to connect.
Brilliant. Well, Dan, thanks again for your time. And we will talk soon.
Brilliant. Look forward to it. Thank you very much. Take care.